It's my pleasure to introduce Nikki R. from Visalia and Cleveland, Ohio, originally. If we could give her a big round of applause.
Thanks, Jim. Jim said, my name is Nikki, and I'm a grateful member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to apologize that I get teared up still to say that. I'm so grateful for the life that I have today. It's just sometimes it's unreal. You know, I hear people read things from the big book, and it still touches my soul. And I got up when people were reading because I got Kleenex because, it gets me. And I hope I never lose that because I spent probably most of my life not crying because I didn't have any emotions. So some qualifying factors. I have a sobriety date of May 29th, 2014. Probably more important than the day my mom gave birth to me because it's the day that I actually started to participate in life instead of being a liability. I have home group, like Jim said. It's the Tuesday night Amity group for women's meeting out here. I have a sponsor, and her name is Pat T. She has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. Because as somebody read at the beginning, working with others is the answer to all my problems. My problem is self, and you'll hear about that. I've gotten my understanding that I'm going to be honest. I don't understand. I can't really identify, you know, my spirituality has changed over the course of my sobriety. The biggest thing is that I know it exists and I know it's not me. And that works, you know, like I stay out of the show, and I just, you know, I came in and I didn't understand what a relationship with a God was, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to seek, and it would show up, and that's what I do. I just look for God in everything, and, you know, it, he, she, whatever, you know, however you want to label it, it just keeps showing up. So, Bill said, you know, this format is like to talk about the steps. So step one, right? My whole life, I tried to prove that my drinking was manageable. I was the chapter 3 queen of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I wanted to figure out how I could drink, how I could figure out how to drink, how I could not get in trouble, how I could drink. But even before I drank, I still have a scar on my thumb from the first time that I remember lying to my mom. And it's so silly. I cut this Tupperware. She told me I caught caterpillars or something, and she said, don't cut the Tupperware, Nikki. And I was like, oh, okay. And she walked out of the kitchen, and I grabbed the biggest knife, and I proceeded to cut holes, and I almost cut my thumb off. And my mom came in the kitchen, and she was like, what did you do? And I was like, I reached in the drawer, I went for a fork, I grabbed a knife, and I almost cut my thumb off. And she looked at me like my head had fallen off, but she walked away. And in my alcoholic mind, I said, if you lie, they believe you, and you don't get in trouble. And, like, I was convinced that she believed me, that I had, you know, whatever. I had stitches. She didn't believe me. But all that did is I just continued to lie. So I stole stuff when I was a kid. I stole... my sister's here. She'll remember this. I stole these chrome caps to bicycle from cars, and I went to school and I had this baggie, and my friends were like, what are those? I was like, I don't know, but I stole them. You know, like, I was excited that I had stole somebody's stuff. So self-entitlement, like, totally. Like, I had an entire, you know, like, it didn't matter that it was yours or that you had paid for it or that it, whatever, it wasn't mine. And that was a fear, like, that was a theme that followed me. Lying, taking what didn't belong to me, this false sense of entitlement. It was me, 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 me. Somebody, I had this shirt that when I was little, it was this cat with this big hat, and it said, if you got it, flaunt it. And that was my theme, man. Like, I was just like, I had to be the center of attention, and I was loud, and, you know, just... It was all about me. Ego, self-centered, you know, just craziness. So whatever. I drank when I was 12 and I blacked out. Like that was the first time I drank and it was a fiasco. And there's pictures that even documented it. Me holding a wine glass, 12 years old, pretty little lacy dress, you know, at the end of the night, probably puked and passed out. And I didn't drink every day alcoholically after that. But what changed is I sought that comfort. Like I felt like I was a chameleon that blended in everywhere but didn't fit. Like, I never knew where I fit in life. And, you know, I just always had this sense of I didn't belong. But when I drank, I belonged. And this is the crazy thing, I belonged everywhere when I drank. Like, it didn't even make a difference. It was like a Harry Potter cloak. I could just go in and I was just there and I was on the set, you know? And a lot of sets I didn't belong on, by the way. So, you know, like I drank in high school. I had one friend. She drank like I did. You know, I didn't have any friends. I just, I didn't really get in any trouble. And I'm going to tell you, so in order to stay sober, I have to be honest. And I was raised in true traditional Alcoholics Anonymous and says the singleness of purpose, you know, is to stay sober, share my story as it relates to alcoholism. But my story involves pretty much at the end, any kind of form of alcohol that you can imagine. And if you have any questions about that, feel free to talk to me. But alcoholism is my disease, and it's a disease of more. And when I put one in me of any substance of alcohol, any form, whatever, I'm done for. But you can use your imagination. You know, like I got to college and the alcohol got a little more unmanageable. You know, I lost roommates. They would I would black out. One that moved out was my sister. She was like, look, you got a problem, man. I can't even do this anymore. My own sister ditched me as a roommate because I was just drinking too much. And I just thought, we all just do this, you know? Whatever. I really didn't get any trouble. I failed out of nursing school. I majored in alcoholism and I minored in nursing. And I was a professional college student. I was there for 8 years. And I was getting ready to get kicked out. And then I found out I was pregnant. And the proverbial, this baby is going to save me, right? You know, and she was actually the first hostage that I took in this because I didn't have a God, I didn't have a program, and all I was a dry drunk, and I was an alcoholic with no solution. I wasn't sober, I was just without alcohol. And so, you know, I spent the whole 9 months thinking about how I was going to get drunk because I deserved it when I had her. And, you know, it was a month later, and I had my baby, and I stopped at the bar on the way home. I was like, you know, I look cute. Once again, all about me. They should see me. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was the only source of food on the planet. And I came home at 5 in the morning. I've made amends to my daughter since, you know, but it still just gets me how powerless I am over alcohol. Because when I drink, I can't stop. And I give my life for my daughter. But I just have no control when it comes to a drink. You know, gosh, you know, I got married, which is crazy because I'm a lesbian, but I got married and then I got married again to somebody else, you know, that I met in a bar because I figured the first one reason it didn't work is because he didn't drink, you know, so then I married somebody else that drank and, we were just drinking buddies that happened to live in the same house and, you know, God bless him. He died in 2014 as a direct result of this disease from cirrhosis and in an intensive care by himself because he just couldn't find recovery, you know. So, you know, I'm a nurse. I'm an alcoholic nurse, and I work around all kinds of forms of alcohol, and you can do the math. I just helped myself to whatever I wanted. I drank when I worked. I went to work after I'd been drinking. I went to work hungover. Was just insane. So I get called into the nursing office 2007 in May, and the director of nursing says, hey, Nikki, you know, you got to go down to security and you need to do a drug test. And as I was escorted off the property from security, do you think, like, I said, hey, dude, you got a problem? I went to the bar. Like, I went to the bar to talk about, like, oh, my gosh, can you believe what just happened to me? I made a mistake. I was sloppy with my charting. Like, all this craziness. So I got went to court, and I got some significant felony charges, and this attorney said, now, listen, you can get these expunged. And about this time, my mom and my sister came and sat me down on the couch and said, Nikki, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to go to prison. And my answer was, they don't send girls to prison like me. Well, they do. They did. Insanity. I lied to myself. I just, like, kept drinking. I forged meeting slips. I mean, I was, like, in so many forms of self-denial and disillusionment. So in March of 2008, I went to drug court, and I showed up, and I was like, no big deal. I had a roast in the crock pot. I had my dog tied up in the front yard. My truck was parked at a meter in front of the courthouse, and 4 years and 3 months later, I came home from prison. Like, and I remember calling my mom, like, holy crap, you know? And she's like, Nikki, you're an alcoholic, man. Like, that's what the problem is. So I got some tools, and I got some opportunity to get some recovery. But the problem is that I did, when I left, I didn't take any tools with me. I didn't have a God. I didn't have a program. I didn't have a sponsor. And I didn't have working knowledge of the steps. And so, like, in untreated alcoholism, which is what those four things equate to me, right? No God, no steps, no sponsor, no program. I drank, you know? And now this is how this progression, alcoholism is a, you know, chronic, progressive, and ultimately fatal disease. So 2012 to 2014, I'm in detox four times. I'm 89 pounds. I have significant felony charges again now for robbery and felonious assault. I'm homeless. I'm shoplifting. I mean, you can, you know, I was... My sister said she had been plucked from Pleasantville. Like, she just had no idea. You know, like, that's what alcoholism does, right? It just takes us and runs us to the ground. So, let's get to what happened, because here's the good stuff. So, on May 28th of 2014, I sent my mom a text. I had been on the run from the police, and I was like, borderline insane. And I sent my mom a text, the number, the address of where I was. And I knew she was showing up with the National Guard. And as a matter of fact, I think she had like a sheriff or somebody around the corner just in case I changed my mind. And I, you know, I had this impending sense of doom. I wanted to die every day, but I was too chicken to kill myself. Like, I was a coward, you know? I just wanted to, like, give up and just be like, oh, you know, like this wonderful fairy tale or something. I just died in my sleep, you know? No, it just wasn't whatever. I mean, I know God saved me for somebody else today, but I just couldn't kill myself. I was too scared. And so I had this impending sense of doom, and I wanted to do something about it. That day, I did not want to die. And I sent my mom the text, and she showed up. And so she picked me up on May 28th of 2014, and my sobriety date is May 29th. And I surrendered myself to the county jail. And that was first of what happened. Second of what happened is my mom, who had always really been there for me financially and helped me out and whatever, when I finally crawled out of my jail cell and called her, I think she had gone to an Al-Anon meeting, she said, I put $25 on this phone to tell you to go, and I won't say the word, but you can use your imagination. She said, and if you call me again, I'm going to block the number. And if you write me, I'm going to throw it in the garbage. And if you write your daughter, I'm going to throw that in the garbage. And I don't know what to tell you, Nikki, but good luck. And she hung up. And I was, like, blown away. I'm going to tell you, selfishness and self-centered, once again, like, I was worried about washing my hair. And I'm going to tell you, by the time I got to the county jail, I don't even remember last time I washed my hair. I was scared to take a bath because I didn't want to sober me up, you know? But this lady came in. She doesn't mind me using her name. Her name is Barbara Burncheck. And she came into the county jail, and she said, if you would quit drinking, you would quit coming to jail. And I was like, you know, like I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, that's the answer. And so she said, write this P.O. box. And I'm going back to prison, by the way, and for the second time. I get to prison, and I have one envelope. They give you a free envelope. And I had no friends. My family didn't want anything to do with me, and I had nobody to write with the free envelope. And so the willingness for me had to come first, and the how. I had to have some kind of willingness to be able to write this P.O. box about, it's a Sister Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They used the big book. And November 14th of 2014, I got a letter from a girl named Amanda. I was an alcoholic just like I was. And she was a nurse just like I was. And she told me she'd work the steps with me. And she didn't send me a honey bun. She sent me a big book. And she worked the steps with me through the mail. She didn't want anything from me. She just wanted to help me get better. And I did it. Like, I mean, at this point, I was pretty, you know, God had taken everything from me. Actually, God didn't take anything from me. I gave it up. I gave it up. God let me live long enough to see it. And I just, you know, like I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and my life was so unmanageable and I had tried everything else. And, so I worked the steps. I worked the steps through the mail and she put money on the phone from the prison and let me call her. And, and really important that happened before this. My sister had pulled some strings in my attempt to try to buy my way out of a jail sentence. I went to the Edna House for Women. And so in Cleveland, I'm going to tell you, we have sober living and recovery that makes me wish I'd win the lottery so I could open some houses out here. Because there's this wonderful, amazing, beautiful God's house. Edna House, and my sister pulled some strings and got me a bed there, but I wasn't honest and I wasn't willing, and I only stayed 5 days and I left. But I knew that people got better there. I saw it. I saw the recovery and the women that were there, and something left a mark on me. And so I fast forward, I'm finishing my jail sentence. I'm making amends from prison. I'm sponsoring women there. I'm just doing whatever I can to stay active. I have a sponsor. I have a relationship with God. I'm praying every day. I told the girls in my cubicle, if you see me on my knees, please don't hit the man down button. I'm praying, you know, like, I prayed. I said the third step prayer. I snuck my character defects, I wrote them on my hands and took them into a visit. My list of amends, I put them in my shoe. Like, I was willing to go to any length. I would have spent a day, I would have spent a week in the hole for smuggling something in my shoe just to get better, you know. So I get ready to leave, and, you know, they're like, what are you going to do? And so my answer was, I could go to a homeless shelter, which I really wasn't keen on. I could go to a halfway house where I had seen all these girls keep coming back from prison because they were getting high in the halfway house. And I wrote the Edna House and I begged them for a bed. And they let me come. And so the day that I was released after my 2-year sentence, my sponsor picked me up. And with my little Santa Claus bag full of prison clothes, she took me to get French fries and hair dye, and off to the Edna House I went. And I was grateful. I mean, when I say, like, I was grateful for forks and toilet paper, I was grateful for a light switch, I was just grateful. And I did what they told me to do. For the first time in my life, like, I just did it. They said to clean the kitchen. I said, okay. They said, you know, do chores. I did it. There's one of the girls that's on here, Nicole, you know, she's Edna alumni with me. And, you know, Edna taught me how to be a woman, taught me how to be a woman in recovery. It taught me how to not cuss in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It taught me how to cross my legs, taught me how to make my bed. It taught me, like, because I didn't know how to live. And I know that seems silly. I was raised in this, you know, in this loving and happy home, and I was taught to, like, brush my teeth and, you know, suburbia, whatever, and I had gotten to the point, like, I didn't know how to live, you know? So I stayed. I stayed, and I did 6 months. And when I got a job, Burger King wouldn't even hire me. I had to write a fourth step on that because I was, you know, I had such a bad record. But I got a job hanging pants in a factory for minimum wage. And I just did it. You know, I was like, ah, whatever, God, you want me to hang pants? I just use a stool. It was about 190 degrees. It was probably practicing for California, you know. But I just did it. I rode the bus an hour each way to work. And I went to 7 meetings a week while working 40 hours a week. So when I work with women who say, I can't do that, I say BS. I say you don't want to. Because I know when it says, if you are willing to go to any lengths to recover, like I was willing to go to any lengths. Yeah. You know, I didn't want to die. If they told me this was going to help me not die, I was like, whatever, sign me up. And I've had some mistakes in sobriety. I've had, you know, I haven't done anything, everything perfect. But what I have done is continue to have progress. You know, I finished that job and had an exit interview and actually got a job as a chemical dependency counselor, which I know is crazy because whatever. I still can't believe it. I can't believe it. But it's where God wants me to be. And so I'm grateful. I go to a lot of meetings because my job is not my program, and so, like, I have to keep that separate. But, you know, I go to meetings, and I was in Cleveland, and I met this wonderful, wonderful soul at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I believe, you know, when I had done the work on myself, God brought me somebody that I could bring into my life. Only until I had done the work, you know, I really wasn't a good person to be with until then. And, you know, I've just kept moving. I sponsor girls, you know, like, so, you know, the steps is step one. I know that my life is unmanageable if I drink, if I use anything, anything mood or mind altering. You know, step two, I still work on a relationship with a God daily. I pray. I give it to God. Then I sometimes take it back. And I have to remind her that's not mine to hold on. And I give it up again. Step three, I say the third step prayer when I'm on my way to my Keurig every morning. That's my MO. You know, my cats can be doing running around crazy and I'm, you know, plugging in because I have to ask God to get up here first before I do because this is still really insane. Like 6 years later, it is like a 3-ring circus. You know, step four, I did an inventory, a thorough inventory. I've done step. The nice thing about working the program is that, like, they get shorter and shorter, and not many things get carried over, you know. And if I'm continuing to do a 10-step inventory, I save myself from the agony of writing out a fourth step, you know. Although I can inventory stuff pretty quickly when something happens. And I still have to, you know. I call my sponsor and she'll be like, why did you write that out? You know, I made amends, my character defects. I continue, my whole life is based on getting help with my character defects because that's what helps me live a better life and helps the people around me live a better life. You know, I make amends promptly, because, you know, it's not all about me. And, you know, I'll be honest, I do a 10 step, but it's an all day 10 step. It kind of comes like, thank goodness I have this God consciousness and I'm aware of it today. I feel it in my gut when it's wrong. The 11th step, you know, I pray and I meditate. I practice meditation because I'm not really good at sitting still. I still struggle with that. I have to sometimes set a timer or listen to a YouTube one because if somebody's not telling me when it's good to get up, I'm like 3 minutes and I'm like, yeah, okay, I got to go do something, you know. And probably the most rewarding thing is the 12th step. You know, I sponsor women, and the greatest thing that I have ever got to experience in sobriety is seeing that light come on. You know, reading the big book with the sponsee, every time they read the big book, I read the big book. You know, being unselfish and helping others and setting time aside for somebody else. I'm sober and I've made financial amends, so when anybody calls my phone, I can answer it. I'm not afraid of bill collectors. That's how that works. I help whenever I can. Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to help, and I do it. I have friends, All my friends are pretty much in AA because I just, that's the people I run with today, you know? I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just, you know, I said this last week at a meeting I led, or 2 weeks ago. I said, like, you know, AA, and I know we don't, like, promote AA, but if they asked me to stand on the corner in a chicken suit, pass out big books and convince people, you know, I'd be like, out there. I mean, I don't do it like that. I just do what I have to do because it's attraction rather than promotion, right? Like, my family knows I'm a different person. I sit here, my mom and my sister and my brother-in-law are here at this meeting. My friends from Cleveland are here from this meeting. You know, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. It's given me integrity. Integrity. I never thought I would say that word about me, you know. I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister. I get to pay taxes. I get to go to work. I get to come to meetings. You know, nothing is I have to. And when I reframe things that way, like, my attitude changes. I'm humbled, Bill, that you asked me to speak. I just want to be a service. And I know that keeping in service is how I stay in the middle of the bed. So that's all I have to say before I cry again.
Thank you so much, Nikki. We have a little bit of time, like, to ask Nikki questions. Or share on, I don't know. We just got, like, we got a good 10 minutes.
You can use the raise hand in the participants panel if you have a question you'd like to ask Nikki. She will welcome you to do that. Hey, Nikki, I'll get started. I'll ask you, is there one particular step that, as you went through the steps, well, okay, let me start a different way. Have you been through the steps more than one time? Okay, and you're muted, so let's unmute you.
I have been.
So in that first time that you went through the steps, was there one step that seemed to particularly capture your attention or really seemed to have a deep impact on you the first time you went through it?
Step three. You know, step three was really profound for me. I'm going to be honest. You know, I came into AA and I was scared. I saw people praying. You know, I came in broken, and I, with this idea of religion and what that looked like, and I was scared. You know, I didn't, once I got to sobriety, you know, knowing my sexuality, I had grown up with this concept of a God that was damning and didn't like me very much. And so when I came into AA and working step three the first time, honestly, and turning my will over to a God that was mine and my personal, that loved me no matter what, was really freeing, you know. To be able to trust a higher power with something and not have it be me. It was pretty deep, pretty deep.
Thank you for that. I was hoping we might get some more people to raise their hand and ask a question.
Can I raise my hand just virtually?
Yeah.
There you go.
I like my sister. I have no patience. I'm like, right there. So I'm the sister and this is the brother-in-law. And the story could go in so much more detail of all the horrendous and craziness that went in my family for years. And fast forward, I think we had like a three-year hiatus. So I didn't talk to my sister because she left that halfway house. When I found my husband, she wasn't even invited to our wedding. So there was so much hurt and pain. And it's almost like it took a couple of years to really know it wasn't going to happen again. When you're used to someone, watching someone constantly relapse and say, I'm going to get better, and then they don't. And from a supporting member, it takes so much to get there. But I couldn't be prouder of my sister. Even growing up, she was very selfish. Like, we got grounded, and I got grounded, she left. But she got grounded, I stayed home to hang out with her, right? So, yeah, this very strange strange relationship because I was a nice, sweet one, right? And so, I don't know about now. But now it's really interesting because my husband and I went out there and spent time with them. And I think my sister is so smart and wise and has just so much insight to life that I don't even have because I haven't gone through something so profound to really take a true inventory of my life, right? I'm kind of on the auto conveyor of life and just kind of going through it. And I almost envy the self-assessment and reflection that she's taken, you guys have taken to look at your life and really make it the way that you want it. Because I think what her and her partner have are just, it's amazing, and it sets an example for my husband and I and our children. And I, Nikki, I just couldn't be more proud of you, and I'm so proud to be your sister. And I just think every day, can't you work this program, you stay sober? It's possible.
Me too.
Me too. So for anybody that's new, who has 2 days, you know, that's what recovery gives us.
That's right.
I am saying I'm an alcoholic. I had a year and 2 days sober, and it just took one thing to trigger me, and I relapsed for probably a good 2 days. And so my friend actually invited me because I reached out to her and I told her what had happened. I too can sympathize with you on missing like milestones. Last year I was so drunk I missed my daughter's 5th birthday party. And I checked myself into rehab the following day. So like going back out again, like it is like has been eating me up like so bad. So I did, and I reached out to people, and it was like I could have lost my kids again, but I asked for help, but I just have been eating myself up over it for like the last 2 days, but I just felt like I needed to get back in the rooms and talk to somebody and have, you know, like listen to like your stories or just like have that support because I know how it feels to like lose your kids. And I'm only 36 and I lost them for 3 months after I got out of treatment and I stayed sober, like I said, for like a year and 2 days. But it just took one thing to trigger me. And I could have lost it all, and I'm only 36. Again. So I can, like, understand, like, where you have to, like, make amends or rebuild relationships with your daughters, because I have two. I was present. I was, you know, not drinking for my daughter's 6th birthday. We actually had a good time. But her dad triggered me and I went out. So now I only have 2 days again. So thank you guys for allowing me to be here. I am actually from Jackson, California, Northern California. So I'm not. So it was just good to find, you know, to reach out, have this a friend in this room, and she gave me the information. So thank you guys for allowing me to be here and listen, and thank you so much for your share.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Lita.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Okay. I don't have a question. But I just, you know, Nikki, I just want to thank you for your lead. And thank you for picking me up from the airport. That day is very vivid for me because I remember I got on a plane to go to Cleveland from South Carolina and I had no idea what to expect. And I was kind of like thinking when I got the plane and I couldn't find you, and you couldn't find me, I was like, oh, well, you know, I'll just go, whatever. But disregard, but you were so worried. And I remember looking at this stranger who was so, like, thankful to have found me and so worried, like, that she couldn't find me. And I just felt like you cared. And it was that moment. And that I realized, like, wow, this is so different, you know, and then getting to the Edna house and all these women are caring women. And it was just, I don't know. And then to see you just involved. I mean, you set such a good example for me, being involved in the house and with other women. And, you know, I don't know. You're a part of my story. And I am so thankful to be here. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for your lead. I really appreciate your whole existence. So.
Thanks, Rick.
That's great. Hey, let's go to Rita, and then we've got Leah after that.
I think I'm on mute.
Nope, you're good.
Okay. Hi, Nikki. It's lovely to hear you. It's always wonderful to hear you, my girl. And thank you for doing this meeting for us. You know, there's no shame in our game, you know, and we've all been down the road in a different way, maybe, but the same type of path that Nikki and Sybil have been down. And, you know, the main thing is, you know, the beautiful thing about AA is we will love you till you love yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and we will be here for you. And please don't ever forget that, because it has saved millions of people in this world. I've seen it in a lot of countries, and it's done a lot of good.
Yeah.
So, you know, if ever you need, this is where you go to look. You'll find us, and we'll be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Rita. And Leah, we'll go ahead and have you unmute yourself.
I'm Leah, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leah.
Hi, Nikki. I wanted to ask, how did you feel when you came across step four? How did you feel? Like.
Okay. Well, so this is really funny. The first time I worked it, I didn't stay sober because I told my sponsor how I was going to do it. And she said, well, no, because that's not how the big book does it. And I just wanted to, you know, like I wanted to fill in some sheets and I wanted to take the easy way out. And I didn't want to do the columns because I thought the columns were dumb and it wasn't my way, you know. And so, you know, fast forward, because half measures avail us nothing. I did half measures the first time, you know, and I stayed. But when I left prison the first time, I drank because I didn't thoroughly work my steps. I didn't take suggestions. Now, the second time when I did the columns and I did it the way the big book laid out and I was able to see the direct relationship, when I took out what had happened and the stuff that it affected for me, but I looked at my part, it blew me away. Like, I was like, now I know why you wanted me to do the columns, you know? I put it together because there's a reason. There's a reason, and I did it the way that she said on the paper, how she said, and the little lines and the boxes, and then I folded it up. And I took the middle part out, and it was the person I was mad at in my part. And I had those two side by side. It was really hard to stay resentful.
Okay, thank you, everybody. We're just about out of time. Thank you, everyone, for a great meeting. Can we get a round of applause for Nikki?
Mm-hmm.